want to do is to talk to you, above all to those of you who are thinking about going into academia. And really what I want to do is talk about A, the need to have Christians in academia, B, to try and talk about how you might think about this as a vocation, and then talk about some of the issues that will arise from this. And it's a very challenging, I think extremely exciting thing to talk about. And I hope we'll have plenty of time for discussion, because I won't have time to talk about all the many things we need to in the time available. I want to begin with an incident from the Gospels when Jesus calls the first disciples by the shores of Lake Galilee. You remember they are mending their nets because they were fishermen. He calls them, simply speaking those words, "Follow me." And they did. And I think all of you have probably experienced that, that there is something about Christ that draws you to him, that there is something about him that just makes you feel this is it. This is the one who really matters. This is the one who changes everything. And they don't quite know where they're going, but they certainly know who they are going with, and Christ leads them off into the future. And of course, we read about that in the Gospels. But note what Christ says to them. Remember, they are fishermen. "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." And the point I want to make is simply that Christ takes what's already there and does something through it. And therefore, I want to say to you, you need to think about how what you are doing at present, how what you have been through, how what your experiences are, might shape you for a future ministry. And I use that word ministry deliberately. All Christians are ministers. We're not talking about those who are ordained. I am ordained, that's true. But for me, all of us as Christians have a ministry. A ministry to serve other Christians, a ministry to reach out to others outside the church, and a ministry to try and engage our culture on the questions it's debating today. And really what I want to say to you is that this is somewhere where we need people. I'm not simply saying this because I think you might find some interesting thing to do. I'm simply saying to you, we need people in the top ranks of academia who are committed Christians. And you are not going to get there by just thinking, ooh, maybe I'll do this later in life. It's something really you need to think about now. And what I want to begin to explore with you is A, what the issues are, what the possibilities are, and also the kind of framework you might develop in trying to make sense of this calling. Because you'll find it quite lonely. Your pastors will see this as something slightly eccentric. Your fellow academics will see this as something slightly disreputable. They will not be on your side. And therefore, the issue of how you generate and sustain support is going to be really of enormous significance. I want to say to you that although you may feel this is rather a lonely calling, it is an enormously important calling because of the role of academics in shaping modern culture. You think of the new atheism, okay? There are four leading new atheists: Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, and then we have two who are academics, Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett. They've had a very big impact. We need a Christian counterbalance to that. What I want to say to you is, that might be you. I want to plant that seed in your mind today, and I don't want you to let it dry up. Because we need people. Because there's a trickle-down mechanism which operates from universities out into the culture. And what it means really is that the next generation is dominated by the ideas that its leaders encounter in universities today. So there is a very significant role for academics in shaping the thought, the thinking, the patterns of future leaders. If we don't have Christians in academia, then that voice is denied. Simple as that. And I want to say to you that we simply sell the gospel short if we don't think about this kind of thing. And so really I'm trying to just challenge you and say, is this you? Well, you may say, actually it's not. Thank you very much. And that's fine. But I think there will be some here today who actually are beginning to think along those lines. Maybe this is what God wants me to do. I'm going to tell you the need is great. You'll say to me, well, of course, there are lots of needs. We need more clergy, we need more missionaries. Yes, we do. But not everybody can be a professional academic. And if that is you, If your giftings correspond to a real need, I want you to think about where this might take you. We all need role models, and the role model I'm going to use in this lecture is C.S. Lewis. Why am I doing that? Number one, you've all heard of him. Number two, Lewis had a day job. I mean, he wasn't just the guy who wrote these wonderful novels. Lewis was professor of Renaissance literature at Cambridge in the days when a professor really was a professor. You know, so actually, this is quite significant. You know, he really carried credibility in his field. But he also exercised a very significant ministry. And his academic background gave credibility to that. But nevertheless, it was slightly distinct in its own right. Why is Lewis a good person to think about? Well, let me say there are two things immediately we can learn. Number one, Lewis's vision of what the Christian faith was. You need to energize your thinking about who you are, what you might be doing, by a big picture. In other words, by a map, a Christian map of reality, in which basically helps you understand who you are, what God is like, what the world is like, and then begin to make decisions like, where does God want me to be? Let me give you a quote from C.S. Lewis's essay, Is Theology Poetry? It's the last line in this essay. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not just because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. It's a wonderful quote. He also talks about this in his essay on the tool shed, you may know. You know, the difference between looking at, looking along. You look at the light, that's one way of doing it, but you let the light illuminate things. Christian faith, Lewis is saying, is like the sun. Number one, you believe it's there. There are very good reasons to think he is right. But number two, it lights things up. It makes sense of things. For Lewis, the Christian faith makes sense in itself, but it makes sense of things as well. And that was the big intellectual vision that drew Lewis into the academic world. The thought that he would be able to kind of way project this vision of the Christian faith as something that energizes, that illuminates, that transforms in a way that might change culture. Now, in the end, it happened in a way that Lewis probably didn't expect. But that's neither here nor there. The real issue is that Lewis saw the need for what I'm going to call a map, a way of looking at things, building a vision of who God was, who he was, and what the tasks were, and then saying, given that, that is what I need to do. And so one thing I want to say to you immediately is that I do want you to take very seriously this idea of going deeply into your faith. Not just skimming the surface, you know, but actually weaving biblical verses together to give you a big picture, a coherent way of looking at things, what James Sire would call a worldview. It's a good word to use. Others might talk about maps of meaning, but the same idea is there. This is a way of making sense of things, and it drives me as I try to lead my life as a Christian. For Lewis, this was an enormously important thing to do, to really go deep into your faith and begin to think about how it might help you engage with the world, but for our purposes this morning, how your discipline, your specific discipline, might fit into this way of things. In a Christian way of thinking, where does science come in? Where does poetry come in? For Lewis, it came in a very big way. For Lewis, poetry was able to express deeper truths that ordinary language simply couldn't do properly at all. That's why that quote I gave you was from that essay, Is Theology Poetry? Lewis is making the point that poetic languages are power to inspire, to build visions. And that's very significant for Lewis. Theology, literature, science, whatever you are doing, you want to think about how does this fit into a bigger picture? How might I take this and use this in developing, why would it call it discipleship of the mind? Look at Romans 12, verse 2, where Paul talks about not being conformed to the world, but being transformed by the renewal of your minds. It's a wonderful phrase. Transformed by the renewal of your mind. Paul's saying, you don't just repeat what you see in the world, you have your own source of identity and authenticity, and that gives you this distinctive way of thinking. How does that help you see how your discipline might not just be something interesting in itself, but might actually be a way of articulating the Christian faith? Now, I can't really answer that question for most of you here today. We may talk about this in the group I'm leading this afternoon. But the question remains, you know, how does your specific discipline open some doors that might not happen in other disciplines? What's special about what you're studying? Because that seems to me to really to be a very important question to ask. Thinking about yourself, thinking about your discipline. Let's stay with Lewis a little bit longer. Most of you know Lewis's career very well. Here's my question to you. Think about this for a minute before I answer it. But I want you to think about this. What role did the group we call the Inklings play in Lewis's development? Just think about that for a moment. The Inklings, you know, people like Tolkien, Hugo Dyson, others would come in and go out at various times, but a group of people who would meet together fairly regularly for a period of actually more than 20 years. What role did they play in Lewis? And more interestingly, what might that say about the support that we need in the future? To answer my own question, the Inklings played two critical roles in Lewis's thought. One is obvious. They were a support group. These were people who shared at least something of a common vision, who actually were there to affirm the importance of what they were doing. In that case, using writing as a means of exploring fundamentally theological questions. And we know something of discussions that were held, but the point is that they supported each other. We heard this earlier this morning, it's a very important point. You can get very, very lonely. You can use the language of community, that's good. You can use the language of networks. Whatever you want to use, the end result is important. It's very hard to do this kind of thing on your own. You need support. Linked with that is the second role that the Inklings played. It wasn't just about support. It was actually about challenge, by which I mean raising the game. In other words, Lewis would read papers he'd written to these people who were his friends. And we all need critical friends. It's probably one of the most precious gifts you have. A friend who doesn't just say nice things to you, but a friend who says things that need to be said that maybe nobody else can say. Like, this isn't really very good. You've got to make it better. And what Lewis found was that this group of friends encouraged him to do things better by suggesting maybe do it that way, maybe do it this way, but really planting alternative visions in his mind. Not just supporting, but actually helping to develop, helping make connections that maybe wouldn't otherwise happen. And you all know about this. When Tolkien read his early drafts of The Lord of the Rings to this group, they found it quite difficult. Hugo Dyson is rumored to have said, you know, when he heard Tolkien say, oh, not the bloody orcs again. Tolkien actually found that helpful. Why is that relevant to us? Well, there are two functions there. Number one, isolation erodes. It means it's very difficult for you to sustain your vision of being a Christian academic if you're doing it on your own. Pastors don't really understand this, I'm afraid. They should, but you know, that's just the way things are. Got to be realistic about this. But other Christian academics do. And therefore what I want to say to you is you need to start looking around now and asking who else is there. I don't just mean looking around you here. I mean looking around you nationally and saying, who's already in my field that might help mentor me? In other words, for example, if you are, to give one very obvious example, if you are doing a PhD in biology and think this might go further, who are the big Christian names in the field who will want to encourage and offer guidance to any who are up and coming? They're there. But what you've got to do is, in effect, try to say, not just people like this who are good, you know, but actually people who are up the way up the field, who will be able to say to me, here is how I handle the academic questions. Here is how I handle the academic politics, because they're there, and we'll come into that later. In other words, you are looking for figures of wisdom, not just knowledge, wisdom. In other words, they've been there, they've done it, they've reflected on it, and they're in a position to help you work out how you might take things further. That's very important, I think, because support really is, or I endorse the comments made earlier entirely, it's essential. Otherwise you'll dry up and shrivel, because you're on your own, you're not getting support, and second point, you're not getting stimulus. You need people to look at what you're doing, to give you advice, to be able to suggest maybe do it this way, but you need both those things if you're going to flourish, as I very much hope you will. So let's begin to talk now about some of the practicalities of this. This is being recorded, so I'm going to have to perhaps be cautious in some of the ways in which I express myself. But I'm very happy to talk more informally and off the record to anybody who'd like to later. I became an academic by accident. I mean, I hadn't really wanted to. I mean, I was an atheist when I grew up. In fact, I was quite a nasty and aggressive atheist. In fact, reading Richard Dawkins actually makes me feel awfully nostalgic. It reminds me of the way I used to be. I wanted to study science because A, I thought it was very good. B, I thought it would confirm me my atheism. And C, also, I still had that sort of instinct. I want something that would be useful, that that should be of service to people. And my instinct was to eventually end up in some field of medicine, but I was going to do it probably via either chemistry or biochemistry. So I went to Oxford to study chemistry, and during my first term, discovered that chemistry was very exciting, but also discovered something else which I hadn't expected to discover, which of course was Christianity. And that really, I have to say, changed my outlook radically. I mean, one obvious thing was I had all thinking to do with how science and faith relate to each other. But there was also this rearrangement of the mental furniture of my mind. You know, what do I do with life? What's it all about? What am I going to do long term? And I then did a doctorate in molecular biophysics and then stopped science because I realized not that there's anything wrong with science, but just that I found something else that was more exciting, that was theology. And so I kind of moved into theology, initially saying to be very useful for going into ministry. It's a tool for a task. And then discovering the tool actually was much more interesting than I thought, and kind of began to excite me. And although I do ministry, I don't think I do it very well, but I do find Christianity to be incandescently exciting. You know, it is not just about, you know, getting a high during a worship song. It actually is about an intellectual vision that trumps everything else. And when you see that, and Lewis saw it unquestionably, kind of it just sets your mind on fire. And the real say to you is, if any of you discover this as well, you know that it is such a wonderful thing. I want to just encourage you to use your minds, as John Stott said many years ago in his book titled Your Mind Matters. You know, Christianity is about many things: transformation of existence, transformation of behavior, everything that matters, but it's also about transforming your mind, putting a good tool to a better use. And so I found that I was thinking along these lines, and then by a long process began to publish, began to write, ended up with a chair at Oxford, then moved to London for the last period of my career, really because Londoners is where politics happens. And I head up an institute in London where our big agenda is the interaction of Christianity and public life. And Londoners is a place where you have to be to do that kind of stuff. and some very interesting things going on there, but I can't really talk about those because they're sort of very interesting negotiations. I need to think about what those might be. But the point I want to make to you is this. I didn't sit down and think, right, I wonder how I could serve God in the academy. It just happened. Maybe this will happen to you. But there are some of you here are saying, look, I want to think about this now. I really do want to ask God this question. What do you want me to do? Are the gifts you have given me, the burdens you have placed on my heart, an indication of where you want me to be in the future? That's a very serious question. If you feel that God is calling you to do something special, maybe that nobody else can do, well, now it might be as a missionary, might be as a pastor, might be as, but might also be as someone who will command authority and respect to a new generation of students in the future, and thus be a force for good for the gospel. I want to say to you, that's a profoundly important vision. I also want to say to you, and I want you to listen very carefully to me now, that this is not about being arrogant. This is simply about being deadly honest. Who am I? What might God want me to do? Maybe it's this. Obviously you want to pray about it, think about it, but my task is to plant that seed and let you think about it. Do you remember the parable of the talents in Luke's Gospel? It's a wonderful parable. Let me remind you of its main features. There is this Lord who is going away to a distant land. And in his absence, he entrusts these talents. The Greek word talent really means a bundle of silver. To these servants. Two of them use them. And they grow. One of them does nothing with it. And it stays the same. And when the master returns, he's not really very pleased with the one who did nothing with it. Now, it's not about capitalism. I don't think it's about capitalism. I think it's much more about gifts. Because if you think about what the parable is saying, those weren't the servants' talents. They were the master's. They were entrusted to the servants. And what you find happening is this. Where what God entrusts to you is used, it grows. What has God entrusted to you? Now, I want to say to you that this is not an arrogant question. It's a very important question. And I mentioned earlier this idea of a critical friend. Very often your friends have a much better idea of what your strengths and weaknesses are than you do. But you know, that's a conversation you might start having with your friends. I'm thinking along these lines. Am I mad in doing this? You need that validation from outside to try and check out whether it's simply you dreaming dreams that are going to go nowhere, or whether actually you've just been put your finger on something that might be real and might be important. So what I'm trying to say to you is, look, think these thoughts. You may well give them careful thought and say, right, I've thought about this, I think the answer is no. And I fully appreciate that. What I'm saying really is, maybe the answer will be yes. In which case you need to move on and talk about the practicalities of this. Number one, you need support. There is good support here. But really you're going to need discipline-specific support. And that means you're going to need to find out who else is there. That really means conferences. It really means you're searching the web to see who else is there. It means talking to people. But you're going to need that support. And above all, you're going to need to talk to people who are older than you and ask them two questions. Number one, what barriers did they hit? What were the problems? And number two, what would they like to pass on to you that they now realize to be really helpful in coming where they are? What barriers will you hit? Well, I will tell you the big one, which you will hit. And it may not be explicit all the time, sometimes it is, but a bit more implicit. And that is just a general cultural suspicion of people with religious commitments. I need to be aware of that. And I think you have to think very carefully about how you present yourself, how you think about yourself, How you talk about your faith. These are very, very difficult issues to think about, which is why I'm encouraging you to talk to older people in the field. Because basically, there is reluctance in some quarters to encourage people's religious commitments to work their way up the ladder. You just need to be aware of that. Once you're aware of it, you can work out what to do. And basically, the advice I tend to give to people who talk to me about this is that they don't need to make those commitments explicit in their professional life. It may be something they keep to themselves while they are reaching a position where they might be able to declare them more fully. If you're an American, it's when you get tenure. That's the big point. In the UK system, tenure actually doesn't really exist in the English academic world anymore because of the economic situation. But actually, it's there in its own way. And really, there'll come a point where you're on the ladder and then you're all right. But during the initial phase, you need help and wisdom on this one. I'll talk to you individually about that, if that'll be helpful, because I can't really say all that much more on tape. Let's move on. Because I want to talk now about something that can be recorded. And I think needs to be said. And what needs to be said is this. I include myself in this, and I think it'll probably be something each of you think about too. Christians are characterized by humility. Therefore, the identification of gifts, the talk about what does God want me to do with my life, what might God be preparing for me, does seem a little bit arrogant. And therefore, I want to try and do what C.S. Lewis would do, which is to give you a theological framework to help you understand how you can position your thoughts. And really, what I want to try and do is to make this point. Humility is not saying, I am a person of no importance, no talents, no gifts whatsoever, I'm going to be no good to anyone. Because that kind of implies God left you out when he was gifting his people. What humility is about is saying, anything and everything that I have arises from God's grace. It's not something I've earned. It's something God has entrusted to me. And that language of entrustment is enormously important. Go back to the parable of the talents. You're given things for a reason, and they're meant to be used. What I'm trying to say to you is that trying to say, I wonder what my strengths are, I wonder what my weaknesses is not about being arrogant. It's actually about discernment. It's trying to work out, look, I seem by God's grace to be good at this, and I'm afraid by God's grace I'm not that good at this. And it helps you set an agenda. I need people to help me deal with my weaknesses. We all need that. But also I help people to build my strengths. If you don't ask what your strengths are, you're not going to be able to do that. And so I want you just to think about that. All of us are weak. Let's be absolutely clear about this. All of us are nothing without God's grace and God's presence. You think of that wonderful passage in 2 Corinthians 12, where Paul is talking about his experience of the thorn in the flesh. You know, we're not quite sure what that was. It may have been malaria or something stopping him during his missionary journeys. But in his weakness, you hear God speaking to them. The words he hears being spoken are, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. If you're like me, you're very much aware of your weakness, but you're even more aware of God's strength. And the important thing is to make the connection. So it's really about discernment. What does God want me to do? And where God gives a task, he gives the gifts necessary to carry it out. You are not doing this on your own. You think of Joshua chapter 1, where, in effect, because Moses is dead, the task of leading Israel into the promised land is devolved to Joshua, the son of Nun. And Joshua clearly finds this quite a challenge. You know, somebody else meant to be doing this, now he's doing it. And he has clear anxieties about whether he's up to the job. But God speaks these words to him. I think they are very important words. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be dismayed. For I, the Lord your God, am with you wherever you go. That's about a promise. It's about a presence. And it's about a power. It's also about a task. But where the task is given, the promise is there, the presence is there, the power is there. What task has God laid on your heart? I can't answer that question. What I can say is if that calling is from God, then he will see it through. Your task, on your own, with your friends, is to discern what God wants you to do. And I am absolutely certain that for some of you, this is going to be, I think I ought to be in the academy, changing the way people think. So I think that's really the key point I want to make in this lecture. There's a lot more I could say, but I really want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about things. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus talks about two images of outreach. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. I want you to think of those images of salt and light. They're very, very helpful. Light is an image of projection. You don't need to be there. You are seen. That's very important as a form of Christian witness. Christian authors, Christian speakers can be recorded, you know, they get around the place. They're having an impact from a distance. But think of salt. Salt is an image of presence. Salt makes a difference when it's in something because it gets tasted. How is the world going to taste and see that the Lord is good if we aren't in it? And again, I'm going to say something which I realize may be controversial. I hope it's not too controversial. But it's this. We can't withdraw from the world. Our place is in the world. Because that's where God wants us to be. He wants us to witness. And he wants us to be salt. If that's right, then there is that critically important role for the church, for Christian community. And it's that of sustaining you for your ministry in the world. If you like, the church, your Christian community, is an oasis. So when you go into the desert, into the wilderness for a bit, you're resourced. And you come back in to be refreshed, and out you go again. That's why I keep coming back to this point. You need support. And that may mean friends who think this is a great idea, friends who can help you, older people who can give you very good ideas. But you also need to be encouraged by your church. I think really, you're going to always need that to try and keep you going. The final point I'm going to make this morning is very simply this. We do live in a very complex world. We stand at this transition between modernity and post-modernity. We talked about that already this morning. And actually, nobody's really quite sure what's going on. And some of you, and I sometimes feel this myself, but some of you will say, unless we get this whole thing sorted out intellectually, exactly what the relationship between modernity and post-modernity is, well, we can't do anything, so we'll just try and get the theory right before we start doing things. I think you'll be waiting for a very long time to find a fool like that. What I want to say to you is that really you can start doing things without a total understanding of what's going on in our culture. When I am bewildered by things that happen, I sometimes say to myself in my prayers, you don't need to understand everything that's happening. The really important thing is, what does God want me to do in this situation? Stop fussing about, you know, listen, the fine details of this question. The real issue is, what is God asking to do? And that is something I think I'll be getting on with. And the real problem is that sometimes when you're trying to, you know, sort out these massive questions about religion, faith and culture and so on, you kind of hold back until you've got this resolved. And very often you find, actually, as you read this new book or that, I think another 6 weeks to get resolved, it doesn't really happen. Start thinking about doing things now. The really best kind of Christian minister of any kind, whether we're talking about clergy, academics, missionaries, or ordinary Christians who just go about living their faith and showing the love of God to the world, is that of a reflective practitioner. Someone who does, but someone who thinks about what they're doing and tries by reflection to do what they are doing and do it better.